If you've been thinking about getting serious with your money, like actually serious, now's the time. The Motley Fool is offering new members 50% off their iconic stock recommendation service, Stock Advisor. This is the same service that's crushed the market with recommendations that have returned 1,057% since inception, compared to the S&P 500's 180% over that same period. This isn't guesswork. The Motley Fool has a track record of finding companies before they become household names. So if you want to invest smarter and you like saving money while doing it, go to fool.com/listen to claim your 50% off discount off a one-year term of Stock Advisor. Again, that's fool.com/listen. Returns of 1,057% are from the Motley Fool's product Stock Advisor and measured against S&P 500 returns of 180% as of July 10th, 2025. Past performance is not an indicator of future results. All investing involves a risk of loss. Individual investment results may vary.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Karen Reed back in court again today, and we're going to take you right there for all of the coverage of what's going on in that courtroom and the follow-ups with Judge Beverly Cannone. Let's go there right now.
Talking about voir dire, so I don't want to run out of time for that. So what I plan on doing is finishing these motions by 3 o'clock. We'll give each side 2 minutes. We'll see how we do with that. And we'll try and get through this. Juror questionnaires, have you provided those? Remember we talked about it the other day? Have the two of you worked out a juror questionnaire?
I know you asked us, so we have not. We haven't spoken.
All right, so today's the final trial conference where I'm supposed to have all of this, right?
Understood.
Can you do it before you finish? Well, let's see where we get with the motions, and we'll see about that.
And Your Honor, if I could I finish that last point that I was about to make just before we broke?
30 seconds, Mr. Jackson.
It's going to take me 30 seconds. I want the court to be super, super clear about this one point. What Mr. Brennan referenced, and I understand why he would reference it in the transcript of the Gretchen Voss interview, the reference to the she called John and talked about Ashley's home or Ashley's house, the she was Jennifer McCabe, on the 28th, calling John to say 34 Fairview is down the street from Ashley's house. My client was not part of that conversation. That was between Jen McCabe, as she testified, and John.
Okay.
Then the next day is when the conversation, according to Jen, took place about Ashley and could it have been some sort of an interaction or an affair or something like that.
Okay.
My only point in making this, and I just want the record to be super clear.
I understand what your point is in making
it. There was no animus. No evidence of animus on the night in question.
I understand that's your position. We haven't heard the evidence yet.
Okay. I just want to make sure that's clear. Thank you.
All right. Well, Mr. Jackson, you can stand up again. Is the defendant pursuing a third-party culprit defense?
That's going to be my colleague, Mr. Iannetti.
So you have 2 minutes, Mr. Iannetti. That's sort of a yes or no, and then I'll hear the Commonwealth.
And I'm sorry, I did not hear the question. Yes.
All right, so I'll hear you on your motion, Mr. Brennan, and then a two-minute response. Jimmy, keep track, please.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Thank you. During the first trial, Your Honor made a ruling prior to defense presenting any evidence or questioning any witness about third-party culprit the defense needed to provide a sufficient evidence to pursue or place that issue in front of the jury. The defense, in my opinion, looking at the opening argument, ignored that directive by the court The very first words of the opening were directed to third-party culprit. And thereafter, throughout the case, there does not seem to be any boundaries, parameters, or identification of the walls or the length of third-party culprit. The varying representations by the defense over time make very unclear what the third-party culprit evidence is, whether it is a particular person, includes particular people, or unknown. We know from the defendant's statements that there was a position taken on the front of the courthouse steps that everybody knew who the third-party culprit was. That position changed in the Ted Daniels interview when they were asked about third-party culprit, Mr. Jackson, and the defendant said they did not know. And so despite the recent position that they did not know who the third-party culprit was, in our argument the other day, Attorney Little identified Brian Albert as third-party culprit, Mr. Albert. And so there is this vacillating position on who the third-party culprit is and what evidence they suggest supports third-party culprit. I took an opportunity to go back to the arguments last year for third-party culprit. I have a transcript, and it's equally undefined at that point. And so what we have now is the defense with a hope or an expectation or intention to pursue third-party culprit, but we have no basis for it. The court has been very clear on third-party culprit, and they can't just come in and start accusing people arbitrarily of committing the crime of murder. Section 1105 of Mass Rule of Evidence makes clear that evidence that a third party committed the crime charged against the defendant.
So I will read again the Mass Guide to Evidence. I'm familiar with the law on third-party culprit. Your time is up at this point.
See.
I've read your motion. I've read your memo.
Okay.
Or the pleadings.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Tianetti. Jim, why don't you stand when it's done? Can you stand when it's done?
Your Honor, I can't do this in 2 minutes.
Well, then we'll hold it. It to the end.
That's fine.
All right. Mr. Lessie, I'm going to hold you to 2 minutes. I've got the Commonwealth's motion on the Celebrite demonstration. I'll hear you for 2 minutes on that.
All right, 2 minutes, sir, when I get to the podium.
Yes.
Thank you.
The courtroom demonstration that the Commonwealth proposes is incredibly vague, and it, to the extent it can be understood, is impermissible. I'm fully aware of what happened in trial one. Not only did I read the transcript, I went back and watched the video. The Commonwealth states that they want to conduct, I'm reading verbatim on page one, a courtroom demonstration of how data was stored within Jen McCabe's cell phone. That's it. No elaboration what it's going to be. They're looking to me, this is a blank check. Similarly, with regard to Jessica Hyde, we'll use a courtroom demonstration to show jurors information and data on both the phones to explain concepts and to illustrate particular information of importance. Vague again, we have no idea what it's going to be, nor does the court. And there are similar statements, and also on page two, they concede they want Mr. Whiffen to use the highly disputed extraction reports to demonstrate Cellebrite software. It says this demonstration would closely mirror the actual Google searches, but we don't know how. It's obviously not going to do it. And lastly, with regard to the law, section 1006 talks about the witness presenting the summary is not permitted to state deductions or inferences. That's right in the note to the rule, and that's exactly what they want them to do, is to give the deduction and the inference that the 227 timestamp means it came to at 6:30. It's in direct violation of the rule. It's secondly, under 1006, the appeals court held that because the presentation selectively presented excerpts of other exhibits and evidence in such a way that it served to both bolster the Commonwealth case and rebut the defendant's case, it was not merely a neutral summary. It was more akin to an argument than evidence. The Commonwealth concedes that's the case. And with regard to Commonwealth v. Sosa, page 14, the only thing that was allowed in Sosa, the case they cite, it says the complete video footage contained several camera angles of the property. And the condensed video merely was a compilation of that which already existed. They just shortened it down. What they're proposing to do is anything but that.
All right. I appreciate your brevity, too. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Brennan?
Thank you.
The demonstration we would be asking Ian Whiffen to engage in is the same demonstration as he did at the first trial. No different, based on the same qualifications, based on the same experience. It is essential that the jury understand and be able to see the data in action so they can appreciate the legitimacy of how the data is stored and how those windows are opened. As far as Jessica Hyde, we've provided a number of different reports. We would like to provide chalks that come directly from those reports. So if there's anything that's particularly offensive in those chalks, I'm willing to discuss it with the defense. There would be nothing new or different than hasn't already been provided. It would be simply blowing up the photographs or the exhibits in her reports so that the jury can read along and see them.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'll get a decision quickly to you on that. Does the defense intend to bring up any bad character or misconduct of John O'Keefe or any witness?
No. Bad character evidence is inadmissible.
Right.
To the extent that evidence could be used for like motive, opportunity, all the alternative, under proposed rule 404, we reserve the right, but we would approach sidebar before introducing any such evidence, and certainly not against John O'Keefe.
What do you say, Mr. Brennan?
If we have advance notice, I think that's appropriate. I don't want to wait until we get the sidebar. If the defense has an intention of offering what would otherwise be prior bad act evidence, but they think it meets an exception under the rule, then they should propose that evidence if we have time to consider it.
Especially if you intend to open on it. Are you doing the opening, Ms. Gianetti?
I will not be doing the opening this time, and I do not believe we will be opening on that at all.
All right. So, okay. So what I'll do is not during the opening and only with advance notice and a ruling.
What would the advance notice be, Your Honor?
A week before a week before the evidence starts.
Thank you.
Okay, that's paper 587, Mr. Clark.
Thank you.
Commonwealth's motion for an offer of proof regarding calling District Attorney Morrissey and victim witness advocate Steve Nelson. And it also includes a request to exempt from sequestration.
Your Honor, with regard to this motion, we have no objection to an offer of proof as necessitated by the court's guidance.
Yep.
The issues do go strictly to trial strategy and attorney work product, so any such offer of proof, we make that ex parte. I can tell the court, just to kind of streamline things, we would not be seeking either of these individuals in our case in chief. They would be merely impeachment if necessary.
Okay.
Certainly we could make those offers of proof at the appropriate time.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. I'm satisfied with that. What's the Commonwealth's position? You satisfied with that?
I am. I would like the victim witness advocate to be able to...
Yes, the victim witness advocate, he'll be able to come in for trial.
I wasn't worried about the sequestration aspect of it. I should have mentioned that.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, so they're both exempt from sequestration. Okay. So the other motions do seem like they may take a little bit more time. I'm going to let's try this one, see how we can do with this. So the Commonwealth's motion in limine to prohibit reference to the pending internal affairs investigation, sustained findings unrelated to this case are unfounded allegations. Well, this is in a little bit different posture now than when the Commonwealth filed it back on March 10th, right, with Michael Proctor being fired. Do you need some time to reconfigure this, or you want to just be heard? And for this, I'll give you both 3 or 4 minutes.
I think it would be helpful to have more time. I can report that when we learned that Mr. Proctor was fired, we filed a request for all the IA files. We included the defense. and I understand there was a production produced to us.
Oh, okay.
To both of us. Now, I have not seen it.
Okay.
It may be voluminous. It's something I'd like to review. I'm expecting that there may be many pieces of material in that production that is going to be relevant for the defense in this case. And if I have a chance to review it, much of it I may not object to, but there are some fundamental things I'd object to. Traditionally, ultimate findings or opinions of an advisory board or a body aren't admissible. So there will be some constant argument about what is objectionable, but I think a review of the material is helpful so we can better define what is in there and what should be admissible and what shouldn't.
All right, so you just received it. When do you anticipate being able to review it and forward at least what you feel the rules require you to forward? And then if there's anything else that I have to decide, how long will it take you to review it and provide defense counsel with everything that you believe you're required to provide them?
They have a copy of everything that we got.
Oh, okay.
So we had them on the email so they could get everything that we received. We don't have anything they don't have.
Oh, okay.
So it's really just an evidentiary argument. Can, for example, a firing, can that come in that he was fired? Can the conclusions of the board come in, whatever their position is? Maybe they found him acting unbecoming of an officer. I don't know. But those type of conclusions are what I'll probably object to. The raw material, I haven't read it. I hear it's voluminous. Need some time to read it.
Okay. How much time?
Well, I would need, I think, till the end of next week.
Is that a same timetable you would have whoever's arguing it for the defense?
That's fine, Your Honor. I would just ask for notice about what specifically the Commonwealth is seeking to exclude. There were some,
right.
Even just in the motion that they filed, there's inconsistencies.
Yeah, but I think it's all different now, right?
Exactly. But there's just inconsistencies between the title and then what's actually in the body of the motion. So as long as I have clarity, then I know what to address.
Okay. All right. Is this something we should come in the day before impanelment and deal with?
I'm happy to come in if the court's available.
Want to do that?
That's fine, Your Honor.
I'd rather not have anything, but I think it makes sense that we at least give you that time and then the weekend. And if you go through it, I'd like something by next Friday, too, if there are materials that the two of you are disagreeing about, so that I can view it next weekend and then we can have a hearing the following Monday.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Does the court intend to have a hearing on the Monday after that? I just would like some time to be able to review their position so I can have time to respond.
So you need until next Friday? I'd like to do it before we start the trial, but I suppose we could start the trial and then hear it.
That's fine, Aaron.
Can you
move as quickly as I can. I have a lot of obligations over the next week. I'll try to facilitate it. I just don't know.
All right. Without knowing how much is in dispute, Ms. Little, you have no idea how long it will take you to address that, right? So,
correct.
All right. So, Mr. Brennan, by the 28th, you're to provide the defendant with anything that is disputed, and when you or that you feel should be excluded. And when you provide that to the Commonwealth, I'd like you to let me know as well.
I will.
All right. And then, Ms. Little, why don't you tell me on April 1st how much time you need to finish up? It may be nothing. You may have it, and we can do it. So I guess we won't meet on the 31st on this?
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that.
All right. So on the 1st, you'll tell me how much time you need. All right, so Mr. Brennan, since we are making good time, I'll let you go back and finish what you were saying when I gave you a two-minute, when I cut you off after 2 minutes on third-party culprit, and then Ms. Giannetti, I'll give you both up to 5 minutes on this. 5 minutes is a long time, Ms. Giannetti. Let's see how you do.
If the court's inclined to admit the evidence, then I don't need to speak at all. But if
last time I said I wasn't excluding it, you just couldn't open on it. Right? So that's where I'm at this point, and I'll hear the different sides. So
if that's the ruling, Judge, I don't need to be heard.
And I know, Mr. Brennan, you wanted it in advance, but you know, I guess I'll hear you on your motion on that then.
The requirements of providing evidence to support third-party culprit are clear. The evidence has to be relevant, it can't be speculative, and it can't tend to prejudice or confuse the jury. If it involves hearsay or inadmissible evidence, there has to be a substantial connection between the crime charged. And so what we would want to avoid is what appeared happened in the last case, when it was just a broad-based attack on anybody. There has to be relevance between who they choose as a target and the crime itself. Looking at the transcripts, I do not see that they've met a substantial basis between any particular individual and John O'Keefe. If we start from the premise that every single witness who testified that John O'Keefe never entered the home at 34 Fairview, every witness, there is no substantive evidence that John O'Keefe ever entered that home. So to open up an invitation for the defense to start to present evidence, sometimes alleged prior bad act evidence or character evidence, is unfair, because then it becomes a mini trial for each witness. And so I haven't heard any basis or any proffer by the defense that would substantiate any particular witness as a third party culprit. Now, there are some cases that say you don't have to actually identify the witness. Those are particular circumstances where there is still substantial evidence that an unknown person had committed the crime. That is not the case here. They have used names liberally, randomly, and those names have changed throughout litigation, whether it's in trial, after trial, but we've never seen a proffer by them. Who is it that they're going to claim as a third-party culprit? What evidence do they have that they want to introduce? There has to be parameters and limitations if they're going to try to introduce third-party culprit evidence, not only about who the person is, but what evidence are they going to introduce? Otherwise, we're going to spend half the trial at Sarah by fighting whether this is substantial, whether it's supported. And so no proffer has been made. I think there's an obligation to the defense to identify who the third-party culprit is and what do they want to introduce. Do they have a witness? Do they have evidence? Do they have any records? Simply assailing people's character randomly is improper. It's unfair. And then it causes the Commonwealth to have to spend extraordinary time rebutting, which is going to confuse this jury, and it's prejudicial. So I think that the court should order the defense to articulate who they claim their third-party culprit is and exactly what evidence they're going to introduce to support that claim. It's not until they articulate it we can really fashion an argument for the court, whether we think it is appropriate or whether we think it's insufficient. But now it's just an empty box where, as in the last trial, the defense can simply get up and blame anybody and everybody. And that's not the way the court and the courts have seen third-party culprit evidence. There's a standard. There's an obligation. It hasn't been met. So at this point, the court should preclude third-party culprit evidence. They shouldn't have. They could certainly pursue some type of critique on the police investigation. But as far as third-party, without a proffer and a finding, there would be no guardrails. There'd be no parameters. And it would be chaos.
All right. So, Ms. Giannetti, I will hear from you, and I'd ask you to focus on, could you tell me whether this is pure third-party culprit, third-party as it goes to Bowden, or is it simply somebody else did it and we don't know who?
It's the second alternative. In other words...
Okay, so that's a little bit different, Mr. Brennan, not pure third-party culprit. I'll still... Go ahead, you can go over there. It's a little bit different if it's third-party as it goes to Bowden, but we know that it's not admissible if the police didn't know about that third party and not act on it. So are you going to tell us who? Last time you told me you don't have to prove that, but can
well,
you make an offer?
Well, it's still our position that we don't have to prove or narrow it to one potential third party culprit.
Are you saying it's several?
Three, yes.
Okay, so can you tell me the three that you say it is?
Sure. So the potential third party culprits that we have identified are Brian Albert, Brian Higgins, and Colin Albert. Okay. I have evidence with regard to each. I'm sensitive to the fact, Your Honor, that, and I have a lengthy argument prepared detailing the evidence against each of them.
Do you want to put it in writing?
I'm just sensitive to the fact that the court is seeking not to, you know, pollute the potential.
So we can do this over here.
It's up to Your Honor.
Why don't I see you preliminarily over here? The defense has to make a decision as to what you intend to provide me so that I can make this ruling. So, all right, next is the Commonwealth's motion in limine to exclude the expert testimony of Garrett Wing. I know nothing about this person other than your motion just says that all you have is a CV. Does the defense intend to call this person?
I'm going to address that, Your Honor. How would you? I want to make sure I'm within your time constraints. So you want me to stand up?
2 minutes. Just my first question is, who is this person, and why haven't you complied with your reciprocal discovery obligations?
Your Honor, because this witness is pending Dr. Crosby, and he's presented because of Dr. Crosby. So it depends upon what happens with that. If Your Honor is ruling on the motion for reconsideration, then we can have a better answer to your question. But that's the purpose, is to address if Dr. Crosby is going to be allowed to testify, and if so, as to what. And we're happy to provide, once we get that determination, provide all the things that I think Your Honor has in mind.
Well, I've already ruled on Dr. Crosby, right? It's just the reconsideration, whether I think I need to rule on it or not. I'd like you to provide the discovery on this, just so we can keep things moving and we don't have to suspend the trial.
We will do so, Your Honor.
All right, so what do you say, Mr. Brennan?
Well, discovery deadlines have passed, and the Commonwealth shouldn't be in a compromised position of receiving late discovery and trying to deal with it, so I'd like a time certain.
You probably have it, Mr. Alessi, right? You're very well prepared. Do you have all your reciprocal discovery that you need to give the Commonwealth on this witness?
I do not, and not only do I not have all of it, I need to go take a look at what to make sure, in light of recent events, that I provide everything to the court. So I can meet a fairly short deadline, I can communicate 3 days.
Can you do it by Monday?
Yes.
Is that acceptable, Mr. Brennan?
Yes, thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. So 607. Jim, is the defendant will provide reciprocal discovery by Monday, the 24th. All right. The motion, Commonwealth's motion in limine to exclude defense expert Michael Easter's opinion of the investigation. So I'll hear you on that, Mr. Brennan. I figure this is probably lengthier than the others.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I figured this might be more than 2 minutes, might be lengthier than the others we've heard.
The defense would like to call Mr. Easter to essentially testify about his personal opinions of the investigation and then to purportedly give opinions about the police investigation, their failure, in his opinion, to pursue certain leads, and to give opinions about their efforts regarding writing reports. This is, from my perspective, tantamount to having a witness come in and vouch for the credibility of defense arguments and essentially summarize arguments. This really, from my perspective, is the role of the defense attorney to cross-examine the witnesses, to point out the inadequacies, to introduce any documents they have if they want to try to impeach the witnesses, and then the witness would have the opportunity to respond or explain or admit any type failures. This is an attempt to bolster a potential Bowdoin defense and a third-party culprit defense. It would involve having Mr. Easter come into court and give his own personal opinions about who a target was or who a third-party culprit may be. That would be totally improper opinion and inadmissible. They would want Mr. Easter to come in and to go through protocol of the state and local police and point out what he thinks is failures. So essentially, he's a witness that would come in, promote the defense theories, tout reasonable doubt, and suggest why somebody else committed the crime. I've done quite a bit of research. This is not a summary witness. This is not a witness that has any relevance other than his own personal opinion. This former FBI agent was a full-time member of the CAS department since 2013. He is not in a position to determine the best practices of local or state. If there are different rules and regulations that the defense will attempt to introduce, that will be a separate grounds of whether they're admissible and whether they can confront the witness. And a witness always has a right to explain or challenge accusations against them. And so I see that this witness is really simply a summary witness for the defense, but not summarizing information that the jury can then digest, like information in data records or phone records. Rather, a summary witness of a witness who wants to come in and give their personal opinions about this case. I don't see any grounds for admissibility for Mr. Easter to come into this case and give his opinions regarding whether he thinks the police investigation was appropriate or not, or whether he would have directed somebody to do something different, and inevitably whether he thinks somebody is a suspect that was not pursued. That is all in the province of the defense in their case and in their cross-examination. So I don't see any relevance whatsoever of Mr. Easter.
All right, who's arguing for the defendant? So I need you to stop by telling me what you expect him to testify to.
I do certainly tell the court that we do not expect to seek testimony or elicit testimony from Mr. Easter as to a third-party culprit.
All right, but who is he? He's a retired FBI agent?
Correct.
So what purpose are you calling him for? What's his testimony on?
To opine on the adequacy of the investigation. He is an expert as it pertains to investigations, investigative protocols, the adequacy of a proper investigation, what investigations should look like, what a proper investigation
how
should look
like. How is
he
an expert on that? How is that a field, and how is he an expert on it?
I'll go
is it
that.
Something he's done? Has he testified on that in other courts?
He's testified in dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of courts, on issues related to investigations. He was a lead case agent for the FBI for many, many years. He taught issues concerning or taught issues specific to proper investigations and investigative techniques.
So do you have a report and CV and all that material
yes.
that you can share with me?
Sure. Sure. I've already shared it with the Commonwealth, but I'm happy to share it with the court as well. If I think I can address many of the court's concerns as it pertains to his expertise and why the law in the Commonwealth allows in 702 allows him, someone with his credentials, to testify to a very specific issue, like, for instance, something beyond the normal capacity of a layperson or a lay juror, and that is proper investigative techniques. A lay juror might not know, for instance, that collecting items in solo cups or grocery bags would be improper. Mike Easter certainly would know that and could opine on whether or not that followed standard protocols. What he's not going to do to assuage the Commonwealth's concerns, he's not going to we're not going to seek to elicit testimony from Mr. Easter concerning a third-party culprit or who that third-party culprit was, but merely what investigators should do when they walk up to a crime scene and how those crime scenes should be dealt with, et cetera.
So is the basis of his testimony just crime scene, like collection of evidence, or is it
witness interview
when somebody tells you somebody may have done it? you're supposed to go follow all those leads. Which is it?
That too. Both. Because if someone tells you as an investigator someone else may have done it, you're supposed to follow that lead. That is a proper investigative technique. Of course it is. But it also includes, as the court just noted, things like cordoning off the crime scene, maintaining proper logs, evidence recovery, evidence photographing, logging materials that are moved from the crime scene over to the crime lab, how that's supposed to be done, what types of logs are kept and why those logs are kept, how you bag evidence, how you secure evidence, how you maintain the integrity of evidence, and things of that law, of that nature. There is certainly, I would indicate to the court that 702 in Massachusetts mirrors very specifically 702 in the federal courts. It's literally, I looked them up, looked at them side by side, they're nearly word for word. And the advisory committee notes for Federal Rules of Evidence 702 is very, very instructive on this particular issue, as specifically as it pertains to somebody with the expertise in a field like crime scene investigations and investigative protocols. And what the advisory committee notes say is, quote, 702, the rule is broadly phrased. The fields of knowledge which may be drawn upon are not merely limited to, quote, scientific and, quote, technical, the scientific and the technical, but extend to all specialized knowledge. Similarly, the expert is viewed not in a narrow sense, but as a person qualified by knowledge, skill, experience, training, or education. Thus, within the scope of the rule are not only experts in the strictest sense of the word, for example, physicians, physicists, and architects, but also the large group sometimes called skilled witnesses, such as bankers and landowners, testifying to land values. Now again, obviously we're not dealing with a banker or landowner, but the advisory notes and the advisory committee on the Rules of Evidence 702, the Federal Rules of Evidence 702 clearly lay out this is exactly the type of field that is subject to expert opinion. Clearly, the Rule 702 allows for experts with specialized experience, specialized knowledge, specialized education, beyond that of an average layperson, in particular, in a field without, or in a particular field without resort to, for instance, the generalized scientific methodology that we've heard so much about in some of these motions in limine. I can go through some of his credentials, but Mr. Easter is eminently qualified to provide the jury information about proper and accepted investigative techniques and protocols. As the court noted, or as I just noted to the court, he was an FBI special agent for more than 20 years. He formerly coordinated with multi-agency investigative gang task forces in Los Angeles. He worked with multiple agencies responding to dozens of crime scenes, including shootings, stabbings, abductions, child abductions, both domestically and internationally. He was the lead case agent who oversaw arrests and indictments. He received awards and recognitions for his work with the FBI, as well as with state agencies in which he was a task force member. For 11 years, he primarily assisted homicide detectives from LAPD, the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, and the Los Angeles District Attorney, numerous other agencies as well, state and local agencies, with investigations and prosecution of thousands and thousands of homicides, robberies, kidnappings, other violent crimes. His work and assistance on investigations in LA and across the United States and ultimately internationally has been noted by not only the FBI, but those agencies as well. Just a few of Mr. Easter's experiences and involvements in some of the domestic and international cases include the 2015 San Bernardino mass shooting.
So are these all on his CV that you're going to give me a copy of?
Everything. I believe all.
So I don't need you time again of the restraint. If you're going to give me a copy of the CV, I can read it. You don't need to recite it.
It's either what I was reciting is either in the CV or in his report.
That's what I need. That would be much more helpful to me.
Then I don't know what more the court would like to
know. So I wanted to know specifically what you intend to have him testify on. But if it's in his report.
It broadly is in his report. I don't know exactly every question I'm going to ask him, but I can tell the court in broad brushstrokes, obviously, we're going to ask him, we've already asked him, to review. He's reviewed NOD 1 through 59. We're going to give him the additional NODs that we've got as well. He's going to review everything. And from that, he's going to, I expect, render an opinion about whether or not the investigation followed standards and training, best case practices for an investigative
technique. So I guess that's my question. So without seeing the report, where are their standards and best practices? Is that something that somebody can turn to and see codification of it, or is it just his experience?
No, it's not just his experience. Those standards and practices are oftentimes reduced to writing. They have been reduced to writing with the Massachusetts State Police. So he's reviewed the protocols that are in place for the MSP.
Okay.
He's very familiar with FBI's protocols for investigative techniques and investigative protocols. He'll utilize those skills and that knowledge base to assess his opinion, or to render an opinion and a conclusion concerning what he believes are the proper protocols that should have been followed in this case. That goes directly to our Bowdoin defense, and he is the primary expert that we would use to propound that Bowdoin defense.
All right, can you get me that report before you leave? Do you have an extra?
I think we probably have an extra copy of it, yes.
Mr. Brennan, did you want to respond?
I do.
Mr. Easter was a agent who did CAST. He did the CLSI. He may have been in hundreds of cases. I'd like to know what cases he's come into court and given his subjective opinion about how he feels an investigation was done. Not a report, not an assignment, but as an expert witness in Bowdoin, how many cases has he gone into court and testified and been allowed to testify about his personal opinion? His experience in the FBI is different than Canton Police Department and the State Police. This is just Monday morning quarterbacking, and it's an attempt to bolster argument by counsel so that they can use some type of opinion to lean on when they're arguing to the jury they should have doubt because of the police investigation. I don't see any recognition under 702 or in law where somebody can come in and subjectively give their opinions. If there is a state police protocol that wasn't followed, then the defense can see if that state police protocol is appropriate. If they're speaking to a state police officer, question them about it and ask them if they did it and why. If this person comes in and gives opinions, there'll be a slew of opinions that are shot like a shotgun approach that we'll never be able to have an opportunity to explain. Are we going to call in the Canton Police Department again and call in the state police for a second round so they can explain why they chose certain actions that Mr. Easter is criticizing? I don't think this is an appropriate ground for an expert witness. I don't see any cases, I've looked through the state and federal court, that allow an expert to come in on a Bowdoin defense and give their subjective opinion about an investigation they weren't involved with. I don't know that this witness has ever been qualified as a Bowdoin-type witness in any court. He may have testified, but about what? And so I think this is a very dangerous proposition. What if the Commonwealth wants to counter and bring in a state police officer to say that the investigation was fantastic, that everybody did a remarkable job under the circumstances? What if we bring in a witness to talk about the fact that the evidence is so overwhelming that it should imply a certain finding by the jury? This invites that. This invites a debate between people's personal opinions. That's done outside of the courtroom, not in a courtroom. We will never have an opportunity to be able to have all the witnesses come back to explain what this witness subjectively thinks was a deficiency. I don't think it's appropriate for expert witness testimony. This is argument by counsel.
You know, very briefly, I gently disagree with Mr. Brennan. He indicates that we want to use an expert to bolster our argument. There's another word for that, or another phrase for that. It's called presenting a defense for someone charged with murder. He indicates, well, what are we going to do? This guy's going to get up there and testify. What am I supposed to do? Call a bunch of other Canton PD officers to talk about how great their investigative techniques were? Yeah, there's another word for that. It's called rebuttal. That's what you're supposed to do. And then he says, well,
you wouldn't be objecting if they called somebody in rebuttal to reinforce a great investigation?
Oh, no. Mr. Brennan said, what if I called a Massachusetts state police officer to say that this was the best investigation ever? I have two words. Do it. Do it. I'd love that. I'd love a shot
okay,
at that.
Okay, so I said let's take personal
shots. That's not an invective. That's not a personal shot, Mr. Brennan. I'm just saying do it. You want to call in another expert? That's a classic battle of the experts. That's fine. I'll put Mike Easter up against any expert they want to call. But the reality is, Your Honor, we are entitled to present a defense. And part of that defense, the Bowdoin defense, is the adequacy of the investigation. And there's no question that a proper homicide investigation is not something within...
I don't know. So if you can give me a case site for that, all right, that expert testimony regarding a Bowdoin defense, I've never seen it. I've never seen it in research or anything. So I'd like a case site.
There are certainly cases outside the jurisdiction.
Yeah, Massachusetts case. If not, you can give me the outside cases, but I don't believe there's a Massachusetts case where this has been done.
We have searched and searched for a specific case in Massachusetts. To our finding, there isn't one directly on point, but there are plenty, there's a myriad cases outside the jurisdiction where investigators are called consistently, especially on behalf of the defense, to talk about adequacy of an investigation. Right. That is an expert field, one that's utilized throughout the country.
So I need
all the
some
time.
Authority, and the more persuasive the authority, the better chance you have at this. Okay?
Sure.
All right. So I think that's it for the motions in limine. Did I miss anything? Well, I need that. Oh.
Your Honor, earlier you alluded to the defense wanted to talk further about the ARCA issue, the Rule 14. You said we'll put that off until the end, if I heard you correctly.
I thought you and Mr. Brennan were going to talk about it first. Is that your understanding, Mr. Brennan?
Yes, and we have not.
Yes. So that was my understanding. So, impanelment, you don't have anything for me for impanelment?
I regret we don't. We have not spoken.
Your Honor, if I may, on one point on the impanelment.
Sure.
I just know it's the court's preference to have a one-page front and back questionnaire.
Yes.
I was wondering if, in light of the unprecedented pretrial publicity in this case, if Your Honor would consider an additional one-page juror questionnaire that deals with just pretrial publicity. Last month in the Chisholm case, the SJC outlined kind of appropriate questions.
Right.
If in additional to the front and back, there was just one questionnaire that focused just on pretrial publicity, I think that would expedite the impanelment process.
I think that makes sense. Is there any objection from the defense on that? There's been an extraordinary amount of publicity, even far more than the last trial, and so close to jury impanelment, it makes sense to me.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I was looking at it for outside cases. No, there's no objection.
All right. So I need the joint questionnaire, and it can be that third page, Ms. McLaughlin. I think that's a great idea. And I was thinking about Chisholm earlier when I was expecting something from the parties. All right. File your questionnaire. File your proposed questions that you would like me to ask the Venire and that you would like to ask at sidebar. I need that by tomorrow. So tomorrow by the close of business, I need that. So if I need to see you again next week, we'll let you know on Monday. All right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Well, obviously, it would be a day after Monday then, right?
Yes, Ms. Tiennetti, it would be after Monday.
We did file two motions today that at some point we'll need to handle.
Oh, okay.
The defense just received notice this morning, so they're not prepared for today, but we would want a hearing on both of those motions. The sooner, the better for us.
So why don't we come in next week? So I will see counsel on whatever is outstanding next Tuesday, the 25th, and we'll do that at 11 o'clock. All right. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Court, on the right, please.
And that is the latest from the courtroom and the hearing of Karen Reed today. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our conversations about this case, the hearings, and more. Stay with us.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.